Hi, this is Circe Olson-Westner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Colorblind. I'm speaking via phone with filmmaker and TV producer Regina Griffin. Hi, Regina.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I guess I should mention that you are also an Emmy Award-winning TV news producer. What did you get your Emmy in?
So my Emmy is actually in sports. I was part of a team that produced the Chicago Marathon a few years ago, and have two Emmys for that production.
How cool! Are you still working in television now, or? What are you doing right now?
So, interestingly, I am back in news, and I'm back in news simply because of the pandemic. I came to Los Angeles about a year ago. I've been kind of working tangentially in news, but more news/entertainment for the last few years. So I came out to L.A., was a senior producer on the show Access Hollywood, then got a job to work on the new spinoff, Red Table Talk. I think people are very familiar with Jada Pinkett Smith's show. Well, we're doing a new version of that show, a spinoff for Gloria Estefan and her family. And we started production in March. And then, as you all know, everything got shut down. And as a result, I, you know, needed to find something, you know, pretty quickly. And because of my long news background, I was able to get a job as an executive producer at KNBC, the NBC station here in Los Angeles, and I've been working covering the pandemic and the protests for the last few months and getting ready to go back to Red Table Talk as now production is starting to open up back in California.
Well, that's really cool. That's really cool. And the reason I had you come on the podcast today was I wanted to talk about a documentary you made. So this is going to be a very interesting conversation for the next 45 minutes to an hour. So let's just jump right into the documentary. You wrote, directed, and produced an incredible documentary called Brown Babies, the Mischlingskinder story. Can you give us a brief synopsis of that work?
Yeah, so the documentary is about the children born post-war occupation Germany. Their mothers were white German women. Their fathers were black GIs. And the story is about what happened to these children. And it comes from different points of view, from the children's perspective, mothers, fathers. And I feel like that's really important, especially today, because it's just listening to a different point of view of an event and how it was different for every individual. The bad guy in this film is racism. Systemic racism and outright blatant racist behavior, but it comes from the people who suffered the most and what happened to their lives as a result of being a child or a parent of a biracial, bicultural children or bicultural child in this time of Jim Crow America and the end of Nazi Germany.
So what drew you to the story about these kids? Did you have friends or family members who were Mischlingskinder?
So a family friend, Doris McMillan, is a brown baby, and she wrote a book called Mixed Blessing. And I had known about this book when I was in high school, but it wasn't until I reread it as an adult and as a producer that it really resonated with me. And I got back together with Doris, we had this conversation, and just decided to tell the story. When I read it, the book as an adult, I just felt compelled to tell the story.
Well, it sounds like it would be really hard to find people, and how do you, when you're working on a documentary like this, what is your process? How do you find people? How do you research it?
So, you know, it started with Doris McMillan, and it's a small community but people know each other. And so once you build that trust, people started introducing me to fellow brown babies. And my research process was spending hours with individuals on the phone and just talking about their lives. And it was just absolutely, it just blew me away, their stories. And before I shot a frame of video, it was just hours and hours of phone conversations, getting to know different brown babies. And if I meet one, they would introduce me to somebody else and in their circle. And that's how it all began.
You know, I have to confess, I had never heard the term brown babies. And I grew up in Germany in the 60s and 70s on a military installation. I had a lot of African American friends, and some of them had German moms. And as a kid and as a teenager, I never considered that their family was unusual. They were just friends of mine, and we were all military and, you know, DOD kids living on an installation. But your documentary tells such a different story than what my innocent perspective was. So you met a bunch of people who had grown up in military families. These brown babies did they mostly live? Well, let's continue the conversation. My mind is spinning, and I don't make great sense when I'm having more thoughts in my head. So I just finished working on a book and an anthology, and let's start with this question. And an officer recalled that, you know, as an officer living overseas, his troops would have to come and ask permission to marry, you know, the host nation, and in this case, a German national, a German woman. And he was black and she was white. And the officer asked the sergeant if he thought this whole thing through. You know, what would happen when they got stationed in the States? What would happen if they were stationed down south? And after he talked to his soldier, you know, this officer gave permission for him to marry his German girlfriend. But in making your documentary, did you find that this was fairly typical? Were most of the service members that you mentioned in your documentary, were they permitted to marry their girlfriends?
No, not at all. I mean, it was hard to marry a German woman, whether you were black or white. You had to be vetted, both the servicemen and the woman. Psychological exams, they had to be vetted politically, emotionally, to get permission. And for a black serviceman, it was almost impossible. 1 to 10% who petitioned for marriage approval. It was really, really difficult. I was fortunate enough to talk to World War II vet Dave Me, and he talked to me about his ordeal and how he had to fill out stacks and stacks of paperwork and psychological evaluations. He eventually was permitted to marry his girlfriend, but that was so rare.
Wow. Did he go on to say how that worked out when he moved back to the States?
Well, I mean, Dave was a man from the South, mm-hmm. so he knew what he was dealing with. Mm-hmm. So he didn't have to be warned about the obstacles that he would face, because that was one of the reasons why he joined the military, mm-hmm. was to get out of the South and to have an opportunity. He was a teenager when he enlisted, and to have a better life. So he knew what he was in for. I mean, he shares what a difficult situation they were in. The blacks, mm-hmm. the black people didn't like it. white people didn't like it. It was just a horrible position to be, but he was committed to be a part of his children's life and to be a father to his children.
Did their marriage survive?
Yeah, their marriage survived until his wife, Emmy, died. They were married for about 47 years before she passed away.
Wow. So I have a question spawned from my earlier kind of just blurting. and I don't know if it's going to be a question or more of an observation. Many military children, brats, say that they grew up colorblind in especially when they were living overseas in, you know, and going to DOD schools. Have you ever spoken to any military kids who have told you that race just wasn't really an issue because of, you know, how the military was desegregated, that they just had to, you know, they just saw everybody as, you know, we all bleed green, or we all bleed, you know, marine red, or, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of racism. Was that what you kind of experienced when you were interviewing any of these people?
Well, I have heard that from adults today, since I've made this film, and people who have talked to me about it and said they did, you know, like you, I didn't know about the story, and they talked about how shocked they were because they did grow up colorblind because that's the way it was in the military. But in this particular case with the children and brown babies, they were adopted as young children, some as infants. So they remember how they were treated in the orphanages, in the German orphanages, and they say they were not treated well. They remember coming back to the U.S. and being not understanding racism here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. They remember, in some cases, the children who stayed in Germany until they were adults dealing with racism. They know that their mothers could not keep them because of their brown skin. Women had children with allied soldiers, but the European children could blend in. The brown children could not. Mm. And they remember, you know, one of my, Lisa Hine Dixon, who was one of the people who is in the film, she remembers how her mother would have been fired from her job if she kept her, or would not be able to keep an apartment. So the children have like vague memories because their mothers had to give them up because they could not continue living a life of being able to keep a job and have an apartment and live without being harassed. Mm-hmm. With this brown child. And those are the stories that they know because they weren't with their military fathers. They were with the German mothers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I first heard about your documentary from a friend of mine, Peter Grammer, and he said, "My mom's in this movie, check it out." So besides being my friend Peter's mom, who was Mabel Grammer?
So I tell you, Mabel Grammer is my hero. I so admire this woman, and this is one of the reasons I continue to push for this film, for people to know who she was. And so she was an African American woman living in Washington, D.C. She also wrote for the Afro newspaper, which was based in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. She married a soldier, Oscar Grammer. And then they went to Germany. Mabel Grammer came upon an orphanage with these brown babies. And she decided to do something about it. And she single-handedly figured out ways to deal with, you know, all the obstacles of Germany and American systems to get hundreds of children adopted. And she started with her own community. She started with black families in her hometown of Washington, D.C. Or even before that, she started with military families and tried to find homes for these children. Doris McMillan, who's one of the children in the film, her father and mother were based in Germany. They adopted her because Mabel Grammer started out with her military connections, mm-hmm. and then she went to her hometown connections. And then, as a journalist, which, you know, I just totally commend her for, she used her connections with the newspaper to tell people about these children. And she kind of came up with this do-it-yourself kit to adopt a German baby, and she rescued hundreds of people.
Well, and I think the Grammers also adopted maybe 12 of
yes, yes, including doing all the work that she did. She and her husband adopted 12 children, including Peter Grammer.
Wow.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
And I just heard that a couple years ago they named a street for Mabel Grammer, I think in Mannheim. And also, I think also she's been listed as one of the people in some cultural center there as well.
You know what? Peter did mention that to me. She was acknowledged for her work. I mean, it's just, what she did was just truly remarkable. And I feel like that is what we need. People like that, when we're dealing with hate, mm-hmm. particularly now, mm-hmm. they're heroes among the hate. And this woman, despite all the hate, despite all the red tape, she did what she could to try to find good homes mm-hmm. innocent children.
So how many of these brown babies did you interview for the documentary? And for the most part, then also, how were they received by their adoptive families and also America in general when they got to the United States?
So I featured 5 in the film, but I talked to more. And, you know, for every brown baby, there is a amazing story behind it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I chose the 5 for my film based on, you know, what struck me and how I felt like I could put together a documentary. Mm-hmm. But the people who weren't included, their stories were still just as powerful. It was just more of an editorial decision that I had to make. And I also wanted to have different points of view and different perspectives, because I have brown babies who grew up and had wonderful lives. I have brown babies who came to America and did not get into the best family situation. Mm-hmm. I have brown babies who stayed in Germany for most of their childhood. So I really wanted to kind of capture different experiences, because it wasn't all right or all wrong to come to America or mm-hmm. stay in Germany. Mm. It, you know, just like anybody's life, there's ups and downs and good and bad, and, you know, parents make mistakes. Your biological parent, your adoptive parent, you have systematic latent racism during this time period. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's certainly a big part of the narrative. People got opportunities in America that they're grateful for, that, you know, pretty much everyone says that they do not believe they would have gotten the opportunities that they had in America, that they don't think they would have had them in Germany. Everybody thematically, there's a deep sense of wanting to belong. Mm-hmm. Belong to a country. Am I American? Am I German? Am mm-hmm. I black? Am I white? Mm-hmm. Belonging in a family. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a really deep, deep, powerful theme of this need to belong and feel like they're part of something. There are extremely high achievers Mm-hmm. There are people who've struggled, you know, tragically, mm-hmm. and I'm sure there's a lot in between too, but those are just some of the things that I've kind of noticed, like this really need to show the world that that they are okay.
Well, you know, and that was something I was thinking as you were speaking. In 2014, we showed the film in Albuquerque. We had it at the South Broadway Cultural Center. And both Dan Cardwell, who is in the film, and Peter Grammer came out to Albuquerque, and they moderated a question and answer after the film. And like you just mentioned, one of the themes seemed to be that these kids, now they're adults, don't feel completely like they belong, or they don't have closure. And I wanted just, if you wanted to add some more to that.
Yeah, I mean, Dan Cardwell's story is so fascinating. Dan Cardwell, one of the Brown Babies, he could be a documentary in and of itself, with the types of ups and downs that he has had. And when you then add on top of that, you know, if you decide that you want to go back and find your German family and what that takes, it's really, really incredible. I continue to get emails from people of various generations, not just the children that who were born in this time period, but like those who were born in the 70s, wanting to find their biological parent. And that sense of who am I and identity is so, so powerful. And I feel like that has really been the driving force for many of them. I'm no, you know, expert in psychology, but I mean, all you have to do is just sit down and talk to a couple people, and, mm-hmm. and it's really, really a driving part of who they are, is trying to find that, reconcile with their identity.
Yeah. Yeah, we posted, back in 2014, we posted a little bit about the film on one of our museum blogs, and the amount of people that commented was really surprising. At the time, we were a fairly unknown museum, and so people found the blog post and were actually asking questions that I could not answer, about benefits, about how do you get help with Social Security and things like that. I guess by some of the people, the way they had been brought into the States, you know. And so I started referring them to Dan, because I couldn't answer, but I figured he was one of the most well-educated, resourceful people. Yeah.
He has really dedicated his life this topic, and I have done the same. I have sent people to Dan because he has figured out a way to, you know, find those documents and help people find their parents. It's pretty mind-blowing, because what I should say, and one of the reasons why you know, I try to show people as their full self, and as much as I admire Mabel Grammer, you know, one person cannot be an adoption agency, you know?
Right.
All the vetting that you have to do to ensure that that is, you know, a safe home, a proper home, as we were just talking about, all the documents. So, you know, because of that, and because of all that it really truly does take to make those, you know, placements, safe and mm-hmm. official, to make sure you have all that paperwork, there's a lot of confusion, because not all the I's were dotted and T's were crossed in some of these adoptions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would explain, you know, why their status might be a little bit interesting now as they're getting older. Yeah. So just so that we can clarify, so your documentary covers the occupation of, you know, Germany, the years, what, 40s, 50s, 60s, mostly?
Yeah, like 40s, 50s, because my the brown babies are now in their, the ones that I talked to are in their 70s. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So switching gears to the States now, we're doing this series of podcasts called Colorblind, where I'm asking military veterans and brats to give their experiences of being people of color within the military milieu, but then living in the greater world, which of course is, you know, the United States. It's the entire world, actually. Wherever your home is, where the military sends you. I interviewed a man who grew up as a brat in the 50s and 60s. So we're talking about the same time that some of these kids were born. And he told us stories on the podcast about what it was like living in Germany as compared to the United States. And living in Germany was much easier for his family and for him. And that is an overarching theme that a lot of the brats have said. Growing up in Germany or in Europe was more freer than it was living in the States in the 60s and 70s and 50s and 60s and 70s. So I thought that was interesting that it wasn't so for the brown babies, but it was for people who had both parents maybe. But then this one man told me when he was a little kid in the 50s, his family had to move from the West, I'm thinking it was Texas, it might have been Oklahoma, to Virginia, and they had to drive. And as a family, as an African-American family, they had to be cautious when they were looking for a place to get gas. They had to sleep in the car because there were no hotels. The dad had to hike into town to check to see where to get food because he didn't want to take his entire family in case they ran into a dangerous situation. And it seems so different, you know, and they were actually on their way to Virginia then to go to Germany where it seemed to be freer. And I'm thinking now a little bit about the conversations we're having today. You know, we're in an intense time in the United States right now where it seems like some people think we've made very little progress when it comes to equality and social justice. And, you know, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I think that the brown, I think part of why I was so drawn to this topic was you have African American soldiers fighting for a country where they don't have the rights when they go home. Mm-hmm. You have brown babies who are both black and German, and you're dealing with Jim Crow American, and then the racism of Nazism. Mm. And I just was like, this is just insane. And the hate and the violence and the social injustice of then, and you look at what kinds of conversations that we are having now, is why I decided after all these years of being kind of dormant to bring this film back. Because of the stories that, you know, I heard. I was really proud to have a German woman in the film who talked about she was a child during the war, and she was like, I didn't understand. Like, how are you all together throwing bombs at us, but then separately you're not together? I don't get that. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we are having these conversations today is exactly why I wanted to make this film available in 2020.
Yeah. So you live in California, in LA, and you know, it's been very much on the news that California right now is seeing a huge surge in COVID cases, and then you have the protests, the peaceful protests, and then you have the violent mm-hmm. protests, and you're covering that as a news person. What are your thoughts on how events are unfolding now? And what are you seeing in LA? And what are your, just, you know, give some thoughts and impressions.
Yeah, I mean, this was my sort of pandemic/protest awakening. Mm-hmm. You know, you have this time, I mean, even though I've been working, but you still just have a lot of time to think about, like, what's going on. And then, you know, I've watched in horror to see George Floyd murdered, mm-hmm. you know, middle of the street. And to see that whatever happened before then, that those officers, in their mind, their only option was to kill him. Mm-hmm. And it's just been, it's been so painful and heartbreaking. And yeah, I've been in the newsroom, and I was off the first Saturday of, like, the really large protest. And then some of them turned violent, and I went back to work. And it was just, like, heartbreaking, broken, mm-hmm. to see this happen. And, you know, like so many people, just struggling to figure out, you know, what can I do? You know, I needed to do something more than just my job. I just, you know, you want to figure out a way to fix it. So, you know, this was my way of just coming back, and because I really do feel if people can see, you know, look at history and see what has happened in the past, see, you know, why, you know, some of these issues are just, you know, centuries deep, mm-hmm. and the pain that people have endured, people of color, that you could just get a little more perspective of what is happening now.
Well, there seems to be such a divide, and people are very, very polarized, and yeah. And you know, there's a lot of shouting and not enough listening, I don't think. What do you think needs to be done to make changes to the, you know, our country, and to some of the you know, the issues that we're discussing that will be considered and lasting and meaningful?
Well, I think that we have to listen to each other, you know, that start there with real meaningful conversations. You have to go beyond the micro changes, you know, think bigger. Mm-hmm. This is a whole system. You know, I would hate to see this just become, you know, a hashtag. Mm-hmm. And not to make changes to appease, but to really, like, listen to the actual problems and understanding. I feel very strongly that the people in my orbit would not want to see any harm come to me. But I also feel some of the people in my orbit do not listen to me, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like you have to actually listen to people and hear from their perspective of just hear their perspective. And to take it back to the film is exactly why I listen to, you hear from people who are Black, who are white, who are German, mm-hmm. who are fathers, who are mothers, who are children, mm-hmm. and just listen to where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm. So we just did a podcast where we invited a woman who is a member of the New Mexico Press Association in to talk about news. We did it from a different perspective. You know, a lot of people have anxiety now. They avoid watching the news, or they latch on to conspiracy theories, or every time they open up the news, it seems like it's bad. There is no good news right now. Yeah. And it's causing a generalized anxiety across the country. So we thought we would like to, you know, mention that in a podcast and ask from a press perspective. And so we did an hour-long session on that where, you know, it's everything is unfolding in real time, and it's live, and it's and sometimes you don't get the whole story, you get a sound bite.
Yeah.
And the more you listen to the news, the more you tend to focus on the news that is from your favorite state. Yeah, your point of view, your favorite station. And so then you get only those stories. And it is frightening. I mean, I have to take a mental health break from the news. As a news person, how do you ensure that what you're doing or what you're showing isn't biased or as much as possible, or, you know, isn't helping fuel the flames of dissent and, you know, discontent?
Yeah. I mean, somewhere along the way, people have lost trust of the news. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, one of the reasons I came back, I mean, yes, it was, you know, I needed a job and a paycheck, but I've always, my decades-long career, thought of news as public service. Mm-hmm. And some, because providing information about the pandemic, what you need to do, and where are their resources, and how big the problem is, particularly in your local community, mm-hmm. is information, vital information that can save your life. And somewhere along the way, the trust of news has been eradicated, mm-hmm. unfortunately. I can tell you, as somebody who has gone into, and I've said this before, you know, probably been in a million news meetings, no, you know, you have an editorial meeting and people talk about what should we cover. There's no agenda, there's no left, there's no right. It's just like what's happening in our community. And I hope that maybe, you know, once this is, things have gotten a little bit more under control, that there could be, you know, people could actually go to editorial meetings and see, you know, mm-hmm. and see it for yourself. You know, don't believe me, come to a meeting or listen to a meeting and see how decisions are made. I think the more diverse newsrooms are, the better. I don't know everything that's going on in the community, but, you know, if you have a lot of different voices that are making these decisions, you can have a better representation of mm-hmm. of what is happening, to just simply, you know, share what's happening in your community. Mm-hmm. News is more vital than ever. You have to look at your sources. You have to see, you know, where something is coming from. You know, I go on Facebook and I'll see something and then I'll click on it and I'll see, oh, this was 10 years ago. Or, right. You know, people have got to use their critical thinking, got to use their gut check to know if something just doesn't seem right. And, I mean, that's the best advice I have. It is so unfortunate that there's this distrust in the news, because as you can look and see now with the pandemic, mm-hmm. that information can save your life.
Right. Yeah, and what the New Mexico Press Association representative said, unfortunately, the consumer, which is us, the people, have to do a lot of our own fact-checking now, because, you know, there are so many sites out there that are, you know, they look good and they look professional, but they're really not. And so it's up to all of us to police our own, before we forward something, police and check our own facts.
Absolutely. It is imperative that you do that. Mm. You have to.
So what message or advice would you give to new graduates, you know, the high school class of 2020, who are just setting out their journey into this pandemic, into these tumultuous times?
Yeah, well, first of all, I would just say stay healthy, take real good care of yourself. I'm so sorry that, you know, things aren't the way that you had hoped them to be, and that most of the rest of us got a chance to have and do when we graduated. but the world looks different now, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I would suggest to them, you know, don't allow yourself to get distracted by the what ifs. Mm-hmm. You know, it's time to just like redesign the future, and that's what we need from them. You know, normal wasn't working, and this is the generation that can shape and drive the changes. And you know, we need them more than ever.
That sounds like really good sound advice. So we have only a few more minutes. Any last minute things you'd like our listeners to know, or any thoughts you have on the pandemic or racism or the documentary or life in general?
Well, like I said, for me, all of it sort of came together as this big reawakening of like, what do I want to do with my time and talents? If I can't get this big Hollywood distribution deal, then I'm going to make it happen myself. And that's what that was what my awakening of the pandemic was. That's what I've been doing for the past week. I just launched the film and made it available for streaming. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if it can't get to Netflix, you can still see it yourself. You know, you can see it on brownbabiesfilm.com. You know, I'm just making it happen myself. I wanted to use when I look out and I see the protests and I see the anger, well, what can I do? I can tell you a story about some children who endured the unbearable and came out of it, and an African-American woman who did everything in her power to save their lives. So, you know, when there is hate, there are heroes come out of that. And I feel like that was my awakening, and that was like, how am I going to come out of this pandemic a different person? And that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I've done by making a film available to stream. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't have to order it. You can if you want, but you can watch it, you know, on your computer anytime you want and see this amazing story about what happened this time in history, and this woman who tried to do everything in her power to make a wrong right.
Well, I think it's wonderful. We'll put the link to Brown Baby's film at the bottom of our podcast so the listeners can just click in. And you already mentioned that it can be bought. It can be, I think there's something Tug rents it too. You can rent it for an event, although we're not having any events right now.
Yeah, there's no more events anymore. So it's now just
download.
You can stream it. You can't download it. You can stream it.
Okay.
Or you can buy a DVD. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this has been a great conversation today, very thought-provoking, and I think inspiring. And, you know, I imagine there are many listeners who had never heard of Brown Babies, the Mischlingskinder, and so they will be curious enough to go and, you know, look up your film, maybe Google Mabel Grammer, you know, look it up on Wikipedia and other online sources. What was Doris's book called? Mixed Blessings?
Mixed Blessings, yes.
By Doris
McMillan.
And I know Dan Cardwell has written a book too. I can't think of the name of it, but it's also on this topic. So there's lots of books out there now that people can read. This would make a great curriculum for a school, for college or high school, or
absolutely.
So once again, Regina, thank you so much. It has been my pleasure to talk to you. And so I just wanted to remind our listeners that our podcasts are made possible through generous grants from the New Mexico Arts Council, the New Mexico Humanities Council, BRAT organizations, and individuals who help us further our mission of telling the American military story. And so, again, thanks, Regina.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.